Committee will come together, Health and Human Resources. Welcome, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to have a work session on Senate Bill 160. Would you just tell us where we are on this?
Sure. Yes, we've heard Senate Bill 160 a number of times. It allows the Department of Human Services to require a prescribing practitioner to request prior authorization and payment for medically appropriate drugs not listed on the practitioner-managed prescription plan drug list. We do have the -1 amendment, which prohibits DHS from requiring prior authorization for antipsychotic medications. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 160.
Okay. Senator Monica Sanderson moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 160. Discussion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The -1's half a loaf.
Okay.
You know, I think if it's good for antipsychotics, it should be good for antidepressants as well.
All right. Other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd also worry about HIV drugs and cancer drugs and a few other things that aren't specifically excluded. Mm-hmm. I think, Mr. Chair, that this bill is incredibly unfinished.
Okay. Other comments? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
No.
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair Morissette?
Aye.
-1 amendments have passed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 160 as amended to Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator
with Monica. The Duke.
Oh, I'm sorry.
With it.
No. Senator Monica Anderson moves Senate Bill 160 as amended to Ways and Means. Discussion. Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monica Anderson?
Yes.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
No.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 160, having received the majority vote, will go to Ways and Means. Thank you. Next bill. Yeah, I'm waiting until Atlanta comes back. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 715. Would you give us a rundown, please?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 715 allows pharmacies to repackage prescription drugs when requested to do so by the patient. It identifies labeling requirements for repackaged pharmaceuticals.
Okay. Ozzie Rose and Tom Holt, would you come up, please?
Oh.
Yes. Oh, Dennis. I'm sorry, Dennis. I didn't see your name. Yeah.
Oh, drugs for us.
It's like women and
wife's away for just a minute.
I'm sorry.
Oh, good.
Look at what we need.
Yeah. Are these psychotropic, psychedelic?
Those won't cross the line in terms of our gift limits. So.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Oregon Alliance of Seniors and Health Services. Our association represents the nonprofit long-term care facilities in our state.
Okay.
And this is a bill that we've brought forward. Mm-hmm. And our elected chairman, Dennis Russell, who is from Friendsview facility in Newburgh, will present our testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Ozzie.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for your time today and allowing me to present. Your staff should have provided you some information, should be in the packet.
Okay.
Again, as Ozzie said, for the record, my name is Dennis Russell. I'm the executive director of Friendsview Retirement Community and chair of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services Legislative Committee. Friendsview is a continuing care retirement community in Newburgh, serving 386 older Oregonians per day. The Alliance is a statewide association of not-for-profit, mission-driven organizations dedicated to providing quality housing and services to the elderly. Our members serve over 16,000 seniors daily. Alliance members include federally subsidized housing for low-income seniors, nursing, residential care, assisted living, senior service agencies, and continuing care retirement communities, also known as CCRCs. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 715 because it would eliminate the financial burden currently being experienced by seniors who lose access to prescription drugs they receive from a pension plan, retirement benefit program, when they move into a long-term care facility because of the present inability of long-term care pharmacies to repackage prescription drugs. Senate Bill 715 would allow Oregon pharmacies, similar to those in Florida, Wisconsin, California, Oklahoma, and Washington, to create the systems needed to ensure that prepackaged medications are safe and enable seniors to continue to have access to the prescription drug benefits they have available to them. We believe older persons should be able to continue to receive help in attempting to keep their prescription drug costs down while not jeopardizing their safety. And you can read kind of the history. I mean, this really came about. In fact, I remember I was an administrator when the change happened in 1991. It was a relatively common practice when people had access to drugs or chose different pharmacies. And we would have them packaged in our care facilities in a very similar package that you have before you with your Skittles. And oftentimes, depending on their pension plan, but depending on where they received their drug benefits, they would come to us in the facility from numerous sources. And even today, I mean, I have in our unit dose distribution system, when I opened the drawer, I went down to the health center this morning, and I have four different pharmacy providers providing drugs to our residents today. I mean, I'm getting from the VA, I'm getting from Kaiser, I'm getting from Payless, Evergreen, and Mike's Medical Pharmacy. And our residents were receiving those. They come in a unit dose distribution system. The labeling is very prescriptive, and our staff actually dispense and administer those drugs. And what's happening to our residents, and I've interviewed a lot of residents and actually visited with a number of them this week who have expressed their concern. And just three little short vignettes just to give you an example of the type of residents that we're talking about. Example number one, I'll call her EC. She's an 89-year-old female that retired from U.S. Bank. She's provided pharmacy benefits through her pension plan, and she takes the following drugs: Aricept. I'm not a pharmacist, so I might butcher these names a little bit. Dilatsim, Fosamax, and Lipitor. At $68.33 per month. She's recently been admitted to our care facility. Now her drugs come in those unit dose distribution packages, and her bill is $352.77 a month. She's walking away from that retirement benefit because her current retired provider does not distribute those in the unit dose distribution system. Another resident, she's a 93-year-old female. She's a resident of a continuing care retirement community, served as a missionary to the Philippines and India her entire life. She's a credentialed teacher, taught elementary school children, spent almost 4 years in an internment camp. Due to the nature of her service, she has very little funds and is dependent upon our facilities to resident assistance fund to cover her monthly expenses. She recently required admission to the hospital and now requires three different drugs, Fosamax, Despromine, and Melsoline, at a monthly cost of $97.80. Because of her financial status, she's eligible to receive those directly from the manufacturer and has found a local pharmacy willing to receive those drugs directly from that manufacturer and repackage them for her for $3 per card. And the pharmacist will tell you, I'm not violating any law. I get, this is my regular provider anyway. I get drugs anyway. And so it's really helped her. And again, she's dependent on an assistance fund. So the additional dollar she's now not spending on medications actually is available to assist other residents. Example number three, and my last example, LM is a 71-year-old female resident of a special care unit for Alzheimer's and dementia. She has a master's degree in physical therapy, retired from private practice 9 years ago. She's covered by her husband's retirement benefits. He's a retired MD, spent 30 years as a physician for the Veterans Administration. He has excellent medical and pharmacy benefits for both he and his wife. She was receiving Aricept and Toprol from the plan at a cost of $11.66 per month. Since being admitted to the care facility, she's now required to purchase those drugs from the institutional pharmacy in the unit dose system, and the bill is $184.15. He's currently administering her medications to avoid additional cost and exploring purchasing another Medicare Part D plan for her medications only to help cover the cost. He's wondering why he should have to purchase an additional policy when his wife is already covered under the current plan. And we visited with the institutional pharmacy in 2005 when we initially introduced this bill, and they expressed some concerns about custody and about inventory, and the original 1990 letter that went to the state of Wyoming that was forwarded to us about, you know, the lot number and expiration date and how important those are, especially for recalls. And so we have actually amended this bill to adjust those concerns expressed by the Board of Pharmacy and the institutional pharmacy to, we believe, first of all, make it not mandatory, make it voluntary, address their concerns about safety, because the one thing we don't want to do is create a safe environment, unsafe environment for the residents we're entrusted to serve. And even the inventory, we don't expect them to inventory these drugs. If they get a 90-day supply, package all three cards, package all 90 days and send them to the facility. We'll incorporate them into our drug distribution system and provide the oversight and safety that we need at the facility level. So we believe we've addressed their concerns, the Board of Pharmacy concerns, and changed the bill from its original format submitted in 2005.
Question? Okay, no questions?
Oh, yes, Senator Berger.
Yes, I guess I'm a little confused by this. You dispense the medicine.
Yes, we do.
I would think that this would be really good if someone were taking their own medication. They could keep up with it because this day is empty and this day is empty. You're dispensing it. What difference does it make?
Well, again, and I can let the pharmacies address their concern. If somebody's, if we're not advocating, and some states have actually done pilot programs advocating to dispense medications after they've even come into possession, been taken possession by the resident. So someone would bring you this bottle of drugs that they got from their provider and say, would you please package these so I can track that I'm taking them? And there are some systems that would allow them to do that. I think the concern would be what's happened to those drugs, you know, how they've been stored, how long have they had them, did the original lot number, which was a concern of the board, follow those drugs when they were repackaged in their, let's say, 90-day supply. And some states are looking at that. How do we provide systems to enable residents who are self-administering? And this bill isn't addressing that. We're not advocating that we be allowed to repackage these for self-administration, or once they get into the hands of a resident, that they could then bring them to us and request that they be repackaged. We really took the concerns that the pharmacy industry expressed last time, that these drugs come from the manufacturer or a pharmacist to a pharmacist, so that they have some assurances that the drugs were properly handled, that the lot information and the labeling information actually followed the drugs.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think to address Senator Verger's, having been responsible for dispensing medication to 20 individuals, you would think, well, it wouldn't make any difference whether it was in one of these or in the bottle. You still punch them out or have to put it in a little cup to give it to the patient. But believe me, without this, this is actually should be required in every healthcare facility. Just, well, it is, I think, because it's so easy to make errors in dispensing. And so they truly have to be in this form and rather than dispensing
And Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, I would agree that we are not trying to reduce the checks that are in the system. We don't want it to be more unsafe, but we do really believe that a number of our residents are suffering financially in terms of their ability to manage their prescription drugs because they're having to leave these benefits on the table. I mean, and I'm currently managing, like I said, a number of different sources where they come in that unit door system, and of course the labeling, the color might be different, and if it says Kaiser or if it says Evergreen, it doesn't matter to the nurses actually doing the dispensing. What that label says, as long as the information's accurate that's on there, and they can track and monitor the distribution of the medications.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Chair, just a concern. If we pass this bill, how are we going to get our Skittles next session?
I'll bring you back some more. The M&M's was last year. Years ago, it was M&M's.
So. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senator Cruz, my next session will probably be so expensive we can't give them to you.
So would you introduce yourself, please, now that you've made that statement?
I'm sorry. I'm Ozzie Rose. I reside in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Alliance of Seniors and Health Services.
Okay. So did you have something to add to this discussion?
Not at the present time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Holden, please.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm with Shearing Plough Pharmaceuticals. I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 715. I served during the interim on the Board of Pharmacies task force that developed a fairly complex set of rules around pedigree. That is, you know, where tracking through the system, requirements for where a prescription drug has come from. Most states have taken action over the last year to 2 years on this front because, unlike back in 1991, today counterfeiters are very good at slipping what are not real drugs into the system, and particularly into the institutional side of the system, because the products used there can be more easily counterfeited. Clear liquids, for example, clear is clear. You can't tell them apart. This bill, unfortunately, would drive a truck right through the work that the board did over the interim as directed by this legislature. And I believe the board has submitted a letter to the committee in opposition to the bill. I understand they could not be here today. And I think all of us would agree that it's important for people to have, you know, access to low-cost prescription drug benefits. In all respect to the proponents, however, in the vignettes described, each of those sound to me like people who need to do some work on their coverage, not blow a hole through the integrity of the supply chain and the safety of the supply chain. Someone who's under Medicare Part D, there's an eligibility rule of creditable coverage, and that is, if one has coverage that is not as good as what can be obtained under Part D, then they belong in Part D. Low-income people can get into Part D programs that don't even have copays. So that's where those kind of issues ought to be directed, not opening up the supply chain, as the bill really leaves it quite wide open. There is nothing in this bill that limits the possession of the product to a healthcare provider or to a pharmacist. You have another bill that makes them a healthcare provider today. There just are no limitations here. Someone could bring in a product, you don't know where it's come from, ask for it to be repackaged. The pharmacy could repackage it. I'm not sure why they would want to, given the liability issues involved, but nevertheless, they could. And then you have no idea what the provenance is of that product. I would say if you want to unwind what this legislature directed be done in the interim for the safety of the supply chain, pass the bill. But otherwise, this is a bad idea whose time has not come.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Montrose.
And maybe you're not the right person to ask, but since Florida has implemented this in 2003, and then Washington State has, Wisconsin, California, and Oklahoma. What has the outcome been? Have they had fraud?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moss Anderson, I can't speak to the experience of those states. What I do know about Florida is that they took the lead in implementing pedigree rules, and I believe those have been implemented since that time, may well have overtaken what is described in the fact sheet here. I just don't know the answer to your question.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I guess I'm confused now. I mean, Section 2 says, if requested to do so by a patient, a pharmacy may repackage prescription drugs dispensed to the patient by the repackaging pharmacy or another pharmacy. So these are prescriptions written by a doctor and filled by a pharmacy. So where is the hole we're blowing in it?
Senator Cruz, there's be very difficult to verify necessarily where it originally came from. Someone could, you're breaking the chain of custody, and once you've repackaged it, how do you know where all those products have come from? That's the issue here.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
And I think that's the board's concern as well.
But it also says in 3 sub B, any rule, I mean, it allows the Board of Pharmacy to create the rules around repackaging, doesn't it? I mean, the pharmacy shall comply with any rules adopted by the State Board of Pharmacy pertaining to the repackaging of drugs. So once again, I'm trying to figure out where the hole is. If it's got to be a prescription written by a doctor that goes to a pharmacy, and the Board of Pharmacy writes rules on how they do that business, where is the hole? I'm confused.
Well, Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, I guess our fundamental point here is this bill is in conflict with much of what the board already has in rule and was directed to do in terms of maintaining continuity of the custody of the product and not allowing things to come in from outside that chain of custody. You know, the board certainly has lots of room here to write rules. There's no question about that. But I guess my question would be why direct them to write rules contrary to something that they've just spent the better part of a year doing with fairly wide input at the direction of the legislature.
Okay. Another follow-up?
Yes.
Okay. I'm one of the senior citizens he described, and hopefully I get to be that at some point in time, but I'm not there yet. But assuming that I am, and I have the list of drugs that person had, but I'm not in a facility, I'm just on my own. Okay, I'm living at home, I may have home care, I have whatever. I can go get that same list of drugs prepackaged myself, correct? I could go to my pharmacy and say, could you do this for me? And they would usually do that for me, correct? Give me one of these. Or would they?
I don't know the answer to your question. I believe they could.
Okay, I guess, I guess, Tom, my whole issue here at this point in time is, I mean, you're kind of talking like a chain of evidence, a sample's taken at a crime scene and it's got to be in custody all the way or it's not admissible in court, and I'm looking at a chain of command here that goes from a doctor to a pharmacy to a care home, and I'm wondering where the chain of evidence is broken in that system. I just don't see how that happens.
Yeah, Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, I mean, you're exactly right in the analogy is of a chain of custody. That's what pedigree is all about.
Right.
The problem here is that the bill would allow product to come in from some third place other than the direct chain. If it were the patient coming back to the same pharmacy that they originally got the product from, then everybody has been dealing with each other already, and there really shouldn't be an issue there. But when you have the ability to bring things in from another place and then ask a different set of providers to be repackaging, that's where you break the chain of custody.
Mr. Russell, would you come back up here for a minute?
Mr. Chair, just one more, then I'll let somebody else in. Where are they going to get these other than a pharmacy?
Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, I can go to the Internet just about in 5 minutes and find probably several hundred places, none of which would be legal.
That's a good point. Okay. Have you had any anecdotal experience or problems with this system from other states?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, I have not had. I actually manage facilities for Pacific Retirement Services based out of Medford, Oregon, in California and in Oregon. And we were able to do this in California as a routine course of business. And again, we expect that these drugs are coming from a credible source because they would come from the manufacturer or another pharmacy to the pharmacist, repackaged for the resident, delivered to us as the health care center provider. In terms of a concern about the custody of information, my experience in California, which allows this practice, and Vancouver, Washington, which allows this practice, has not been a problem of the drugs providing they come from either the manufacturer or a pharmacist to pharmacist. And again, even the pharmacists that I've talked to, albeit they would rather not do this, they believe that as professionals, they can identify the drugs. They believe that they actually can if they're dealing with sources that, and I think the concern might be sources that I'm not familiar with. They maybe could come from anywhere. And I think one of the reasons we were very clear and specific that we needed the Board of Pharmacy to have the latitude to write some rules and guidelines, because if there are the specific concerns that they have about the chain, about the custody, about who can get the drugs and who can have them repackaged, we felt like they needed the ability to write the regulations to ensure our resident safety, and we look to them for that.
Okay. Where does the savings, talk about the savings, where does that come from?
Well, the interesting thing about coverage and an assumption that any pharmacy will package in these unit dose distribution, and I think that's the issue, it isn't an issue of coverage. If I have benefits from my, an example would be the physician that was served for 30 years to the VA administration, his benefit plan contracts with a pharmacy benefit provider called Medco. Now, Medco will deliver those drugs, but they will not repackage them for distribution in, and many pharmacies won't. And so the concern that we have is those people that are walking away from their retirement benefits, again, the U.S. Bank employee and the physician for the VA, two just very simple examples, their drugs come to them through, one is Medco and the other one is Blue Cross. And they come to them. Now, if they would go from Medco or Blue Cross to our pharmacy provider, they repackage it, they enter our system in this unit dose distribution, we're expecting we would have to pay the pharmacist for that repackaging service. And so we're very concerned about the custody of information and credible. And our residents, of course, certainly don't want to open themselves up to drugs. These drugs are already coming to them from their pension plans now.
Now, are these a 30-day supply and 90-day supply?
Well, some are 30 and some are 90. And so our concern last time in 05 is the pharmacies didn't want to start managing all these inventories. And so what we've basically said is if it comes in a 90-day supply, which mail orders typically do, mm-hmm. and that's where part of the savings is. Even
right.
My Kaiser benefit, I only pay two copays instead of three if I order them for 90 days. If they would come directly to the pharmacist and he would repackage those, he would have to package, if it was a 90-day supply, three cards, not one. And those three cards would have to enter our system as a healthcare provider, and we would have to put them into our inventory. We're not asking the pharmacist to be responsible for inventorying those cards and dispensing them one at a time, month by month.
I still don't understand where the savings comes from.
The savings comes from these folks are already being paid by the pension plan to provide these prescriptions to their beneficiaries.
Right.
If they have to go to another provider, like an institutional pharmacy provider, they don't have a agreement to provide pharmacy benefits to their members, so they either have to go get a Medicare Part D policy and walk away from that benefit.
I see. Okay.
So their pension plan, their retirement benefits, paying for those pharmacy benefits that they literally have to abandon if they enter a licensed healthcare facility.
Okay. Senator George.
Tom, I'm lost in this too, because I look at this and up in the corner it says the item, the strength, the lot number, the expiration date, and the manufacturer. And here it is. Okay, if I was at the pharmacy in person and I was going to get a 10-day or whatever where the recommendation was for the medication, he would take a bulk container and count those out, put them into something that is round instead of flat and write the same exact information on it. How do we lose track of it? What's the difference between that and me taking the little container home? I mean, the same pharmaceuticals were identified and transferred to the patient. This, the only difference is that this has a provision for an orderly day-to-day dispensing.
Chair Morissette, Senator George, I think the difference there is that if you're the pharmacy, then you're originating that. What this bill does is allow people to bring product into the pharmacy from wherever and ask for it to be repackaged. And that's where your lot numbers and things can be get lost.
Okay,
if they're not recorded, and
I'm reading,
you know, you're going to have mixes of potentially of those pieces of information.
Okay, follow up on that. I'm reading from the summary here, but it says require repackaging pharmacy to list the name and addresses of the pharmacy that initially dispensed the medication on the label of the repackaged drugs. So it seems to me that you have a consistent flow of the source to the patient. Tell me where I'm missing that. And allowing for the development of rules to make sure that a repackaging pharmacy would be following, you know, consistent identification of the sources, the strength, the lot number, the expiration date, and the manufacturer.
Well,
I see a hole.
Senator Chair Morissette, Senator George, I think I just come back to, you know, the fundamental objection we have here is that, as opposed to the product flowing straight through the supply chain with complete pedigree around that, we have the potential for the product to come from someplace else into the supply chain. It's not necessarily if you're the pharmacy, it hasn't necessarily, this bill doesn't require it to have been your patient to start with. And the question is, you know, can you really truly verify that was a legitimate place that it came from to begin with? That's the heart of the matter. In the rules that the board developed in the interim, where there's they describe what they call a normal chain of distribution, which we would generally speaking is from manufacturer to wholesaler to pharmacy to patient. There can be some other players in there too, but if it leaves that normal chain, then a whole series of regulatory requirements become triggered. And I think this bill is contrary to that entire effort.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Bridger.
Why, if this is such a great idea, wouldn't the drug companies just package their drugs this way? You know, they're all in the business to make money, and they all want to do things to have more customers. So I'm confused by that. The other thing is I don't know how this eliminates mistakes unless it's an individual living in their home and truly without supervision, who needs supervision, and perhaps are going to take more medicine than they should, and that type of thing. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about an institution where people are dispensing their drugs, so I don't understand it. Also, you've removed the liability from the pharmacy. In other words, if the pharmacy repackages it and it's drugs bought on the internet and it's not really what I thought I had, and they repackage it and I take it and die, they really aren't apparently liable. So I have a lot of hard things about this bill. I don't understand.
Is that question directed at me?
Anybody that wants to field the ball.
Well, we did intentionally want to make sure it was voluntary. If a pharmacist as a professional has a concern and can't validate where these drugs have come from, he doesn't have to. And we certainly don't want to compromise their own professional ethics and integrity of the process. The other piece about speaking to the profitability and why wouldn't all pharmacies, quite honestly, there are margins in the drugs that this bill the repackaging bill would not afford the dispensing pharmacist. Those margins would go away, and they would then determine some reasonable repackaging fee. And we didn't even, the California bill even set the limit consistent with the Medi-Cal limit for repackaging drugs, so that the institutional pharmacies could only charge up to, I mean, it used to be $5.80. I don't know what it is now. So there is actually some margin reduction in terms of profitability of the drug itself. And quite honestly, those institutional pharmacies provide pharmacy consultation and some other things to us as facilities, as operators, that we benefit from. Those margins and that net revenue for them enable them to sponsor workshops and conferences and do pharmacy consulting. That if a lot of this activity happened and those margins were to shrink and that profit were to be reduced, they would probably have to come up with a fee schedule to then start charging us as healthcare providers for those services they've historically provided to us for free. And we recognize our goal in this is to do what's in the best interest of the resident, and if that means we have to pay for some services because the margins that came out of these repackaged drugs go away, it's they're still the right thing to do for the residents that we serve.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One of the things also, when you dispense drugs to the 93-year-old, isn't there someone writing down what drug was dispensed, what time it was dispensed, what day it was dispensed, and some initial of who dispensed it?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, exactly. The requirements for us in terms of documentation, inventory, custody, documentation, the charting that we have to do is very, very prescriptive and very stringent. And yes, we do. We track that. But I'll tell you and really confirm a comment earlier by Senator Mona Sanderson about how useful these cards really are. When you're serving, you know, let's say you have 150 residents that you are serving and you're dispensing medications for those, it's so helpful to have those cues and to have this. And I would agree, this would be very, very helpful for people in their own homes as well, because a little bit of memory impairment or a little bit of even dehydration can create some memory loss. And so to know that today, what date today is, and that bubble is empty, I know I took my medicine today so I don't take it again.
Well, last follow-up, Mr. Yes. Chair. Unfortunately, when people live in their homes and they are not really operating on as many lights as they should, many times they take their drugs and stir it all together, sir. So there are a lot of problems with drugs.
Okay. Yes, Senator George.
Just really quickly, and Senator Verger just hits on my point. It appears as far as patient safety, which is all I care about, is that this procedure seems to have the most security to make sure that on the given time, the person took the given drug that was supposed to have been taken, and we have a record of it. So, I mean, help me out here.
I'm surprised that there is not someone here from the Board of Pharmacy. They usually show up in force when we have these discussions. They do have a letter. Do you all have the letter from the Board?
I don't.
You don't have the letter from the Board of Pharmacy.
Only you, because you're special.
Okay, the Board of Pharmacy has discussed the issue at the past meeting. As a result of the comprehensive discussion, the Board chose to oppose the bill. The Board of Pharmacy is responsible under ORS 689 to regulate the practice of pharmacy and distribution of drugs in the state and in interest of the public health, safety, and welfare. The administrative rule, which I mentioned, ORS Chapter 855, developed, reviewed, and updated by the Board over the years, spells out in detail the drug distribution process. The process, this distribution process includes proper labeling, storage of drugs, and the integrity of the distribution of drugs through the normal chain of command. The Board is concerned with the legality of the pharmacist repackaging previously dispensed drugs into the federal and state regulations. This will present several unanswered questions. We've already talked about the expiration date, the origin, tampering, and so on. So they feel that there is a safety issue here, and they also feel that they have done some newly adopted rules Okay. But they say that if we pass this, it would undermine the efforts of the board to monitor the safety and integrity of the program. Now, my question is, will the Board of Pharmacy have an opportunity to do rules under this statute? They will, to adjust to the statute. And that seems to me to be a safeguard. Other questions, concerns?
Mr. Chair, I know we're not in work session, but I truly believe that actually this is a money issue. And I'd rather talk about that, because the pharmacies will lose money if they're not able to provide the drugs through their pharmacy rather than from this low income. So I can understand why the Board of Pharmacy took the position they did, as well as the association. So I feel it's extremely a safe thing, but I think it's going to help the patient. The patient will not have to pay as much. And to me, I think that's a sorry state, that we would not have a program that would actually save the patient money rather than looking at how much it's going to cost or prevent a pharmacy from making money. Just editorial.
Mm-hmm. Senator Cruz.
I think where we're trying to go is probably the right pace, and I do wish the Board of Pharmacy was here, because I do think there needs to be some continuity in the system. When Tom brought up the internet sale of drugs, that's a huge issue. I mean, that is a massive, huge issue, and there are no controls over that, none whatsoever. And in fact, I know of a couple suicides that have happened because of the internet sale of drugs, and so that's a huge issue. Things like expiration dates, things like that, I think are important. I wish the board was here, because I would think, this allows a pharmacy. Number one, a pharmacy doesn't have to go into the repackaging business. They don't have to. But it allows them to set up the rules under which they will. And if I was a pharmacist and I was setting up rules under which I was willing to do that, I'd damn sure want to know where the drugs were coming from before I'd be willing to accept them and repackage them. So, I'm thinking there's got to be... I guess my other concern or question at this point is... I'm not quite sure what we're undermining. Could you?
Well, I can, Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, I can take a crack at that. I mean, yes, it's voluntary, but I think history suggests, and it's not unique to this set of providers, that which state law allows, a payer will say a provider shall do. And there would be pressure brought to. More or less force people to do it, even if they don't particularly want to, through the payment system. And I would like to address the money issue that Senator Moss Anderson raised. I mean, just from our perspective as a manufacturer, there is not a direct financial impact on whether the product is dispensed unit dose or whether it's dispensed in ordinary retail. That's not the issue. There is an issue of liability if someone... gets a product that says it was one of ours and it really wasn't one of ours, we still get sued. And that is a cost not just to us but the entire healthcare system.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I think we will come back to this. I feel that there's not enough information and certainty. I don't know if I would be willing to carry this bill on the floor right now. I need more information. We will have another hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 889.
Good for Joanne. We can be there to punch.
Sometimes.
going to ask Senator Verdi to carry this bill. I want him to be in full support. I have questions.
This must be a good bill. I'm looking at who's sponsoring.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a lot of people to testify over a very simple bill. Lynn Belcher, go ahead and read the talk about the
bill. Senate Bill 889 declares that the practice of pharmacy is a healthcare professional practice.
Yeah. Okay. Jim Thompson, would you come up, please? Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
I'm Lynn Belcher. I'm a clinical specialist pharmacist with Legacy Health System in Portland. I'm also the immediate past president of the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists, and I'd like to speak in support of this bill. Pharmacists have been practicing as healthcare providers in my health system for as long as I can remember. I actually have a practice as a clinical specialist managing patients who are on warfarin, which is a drug for to prevent blood clots. And our health system, we manage about probably 3,000 or 4,000 lives patients on warfarin. We have 7 sites where pharmacists are actually the doing the monitoring, doing the patient education, doing dose adjustment, working with physicians. We've been tracking our outcomes with regard to how our patients do against all the outcomes of patients across the country, physician managed, nurse managed, and our outcomes are as good, if not better, than any of those other sites. So I do speak to the fact that pharmacists are practicing in that setting.
I'm surprised that you're not already listed as practitioners. Yes, Monica Sanderson.
I need to know the ramifications of being called a healthcare profession rather than a friend, because
I think
I think it has a little bit more comment from my part. Does this affect reimbursement?
It does.
And it would increase your reimbursement rates.
It would increase our ability to get reimbursed. In a lot of cases, we are not reimbursed for some of that. We are reimbursed in under the physicians that we practice with or the clinics that we work in, but as individual practitioners, we're not reimbursed.
Because it's the same thing regarding family therapists and counselors are providing services that psychiatrists and psychologists that.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you know what the insurers, what the fiscal impact had, what is the insurers?
I don't. I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that, okay. But I know that in most cases, you know, like in my clinic where I work, the physician doesn't have to do this and doesn't have to see patients that I see, and my bill is a lot less than a physician who would have to manage this if I wasn't doing it. So it, in a lot of ways, it's cost effective, I think, to have nurses, pharmacists, other healthcare providers managing pieces that they're actually, that they have expertise to manage.
Okay. Thank you. Jim?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Thompson, Executive Director of the Oregon Pharmacy Association. We actually initiated this bill. And speaking to Senator Morris Anderson's question, it has a lot to do with reimbursement. As you know, we're, just as one example, very deeply involved in flu shot immunization in the state of Oregon. We have hundreds of pharmacists trained to do that, and they are doing it very effectively. Some of the benefit managers have taken it upon themselves to find a legal loophole, that being that pharmacists are not listed statutorily as professional healthcare professionals, to deny payment. The same organizations are paying pharmacists to do this in other states. They just choose not to do it in Oregon. So the thought behind this bill initially was, well, we'll clean up that problem real fast. We'll get the provision changed. Because as you hear from other testimony today, I don't think there's any doubt that pharmacists in Oregon are healthcare providers, and they have been for a long time. But it's not right to try to manage health care costs and provision the way we're trying to do it, and then say a certain class of providers won't be paid for those services. And that speaks right to the heart of this issue. The other issue that you should be thinking about regarding this is healthcare is in a major state of change. We're going to see more change in the pharmacy profession in the next 5 years than we've seen in the last 50 years because it's moving clinical. Part of that is because we get better patient outcomes when pharmacists are part of the whole treatment plan, doctors, nurses, specialists, pharmacists, right out the other end, and there's documentation to show that's true. And part of it is just plain because we don't have enough people to provide services anymore. Many of the clinics, for instance, that have referred their flu shot patients to local pharmacies are doing it because, number one, they don't make any money at it, and number two, they don't have the staff to do it. So that's being moved out at lesser cost, less cost to the healthcare system, and better immunization rates than what we were probably seeing without it. So it's a very simple bill. It does not extend the scope of practice of pharmacists in any way. That's all governed, even immunizations, governed by state statute. So all it does is clean up a little corner that allows for pharmacists to be paid for the services they provide, which most of them are being paid anyway. It's just a small minority of third-party payers have decided to make this a legal issue.
Thank you. When we talk about rural health care providers and the need in rural Oregon, I believe pharmacists come under that category.
Absolutely.
We need pharmacists in rural Oregon. I also raised a question in the Healthcare Reform Committee several times, wanting to know if we know who all the providers are out there that we're talking about. Who are all these healthcare providers that we have to work into the new healthcare reform or make sure they don't fall through the cracks? And that was the day that you came to me and said, here's a bill making us healthcare providers, and it kind of boggled my mind because
I
just always assumed you guys were healthcare providers.
Well, I think pharmacists assumed they were too, because they certainly are. It's only when the attorney from some insurance company points out to you that you're not getting paid because you're not one, and it says right here in statute by its absence you're not one, because I had to scratch my head and dig through the law books myself because I couldn't believe there wasn't something in there. We have a statute that allows immunization and regulates it. We have a statute that requires pharmacists to take training in pain management, which is certainly, if you're managing some chronic pain, you better be a healthcare provider. And we have various other statutes that, and lots of regulations that govern the role of pharmacists, but yet they're just denied the title of healthcare provider. And it doesn't make any sense. But,
Yes. Okay, Senator Berger.
Well, you know, in rural Oregon, they say if you have a good pharmacist, that's just about as good as having a good doctor.
That's also true in urban Oregon.
Well, I don't live in urban Oregon, okay. So I couldn't testify to that. But one of the things I just want to comment about the immunization program, you know, it's just every once in a while we do things because it's the necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. And it works really well. And this is just something that was done because there weren't enough people, and yet it has worked really well. And pharmacists know how to detect anaphylactic shock. They know how to detect a lot
required training.
Prior training. And so I think that it was one of the things. I wish we could think of maybe 9 other ideas that would work that well.
Senator Berger, we are thinking of those 9 other.
Good.
We're just not there yet.
Good.
You know as well as I do, healthcare is going to change because we can't afford to do what we're doing with the outcomes we're getting. So pharmacists are just one piece of the puzzle, and not denigrating anyone else's contribution, but we have to find a different system to supply healthcare and get better outcomes than we're getting at the same or less cost. And it isn't going to happen by doing the same thing we've always been doing.
So.
Thank you. I'll go through the list. Sean Malik, would you come up, please? George Girding, would you come up? Is George here? Yes, indeed. And then we have 2 other people to testify.
Chair, I'm just wondering why the sponsors of this bill didn't provide the committee with candy.
This is your number.
I suppose I could share.
It will?
I think you're first. Go ahead.
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Shah Malik, and I work for CFA, mm-hmm. and I've been in pharmacy for a long time in Oregon. I'll just say two things which have really impacted the health of our citizens, not only in this state, but throughout the country. One is immunizations. Jim Thompson said flu shots, we just don't do flu shots. Like right now, our pharmacists, not only in the state of Oregon, but all over the United States, we are the largest providers of shingles vaccine, because all the people, they cannot get shingles vaccine through their doctor's offices because they cannot bill Medicare Part D. Mm-hmm. That is one part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And the other one is that we also do medication therapy management, and that was a requirement by the CMS in 2005. So we are doing all these things besides putting little pills in the bottles. We do a lot more than doing that. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes.
Go ahead, Senator Monson.
Do other states, are they able to bill Medicare Part D? Have they passed legislation like this?
Medicare Part D is throughout 50 states.
So we have that ability?
Yes.
Yes.
And here, Medicare has allowed the pharmacists to bill for the services under Medicare Part B for administration. And of all the insurance companies that we deal with, they said if we could have a provider number, we could go beyond doing immunizations, we could be doing medication therapy management, we could be doing all the biometric testing that would include screening, as well as other services that we could provide very easily.
When
all of a sudden then people talk about reducing the cost burden of health care in the country, I think pharmacists can provide that.
Okay, just follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Well, I take a look at giving a flu shot to the elderly is very straightforward. I mean, it's very simple. But this would then allow you to give childhood immunizations that are far more complicated. You have a series of, you have to make sure you don't give too many. I mean, I have a concern that you could then get into the business of giving childhood immunizations. Is that the intent of this bill?
Senator Anderson, that is a very important point that you brought up. We as pharmacists had made sure that pharmacists per se will not provide immunization to the children unless the physician sends them to the pharmacist. In other words, for 11 and under, all we need is somebody to go to the physician, pediatrician, get the prescription. They are under the care of the physician or the pediatrician. We do is administer. In state of Washington, we do that.
So just a follow-up. Mm-hmm. So this bill is primarily then focused on getting reimbursement for giving flu shots to those that are not Medicare eligible.
Actually, I was not talking just about flu shots. I was talking about all the pharmacy-related services, patient care services that pharmacists provide. And that is like medication therapy management, like doing your screening. Like if some of us in the room need a prostate test, a pharmacist should be able to do that. We have the accessibility.
Thank you.
Interesting. Becoming more complex.
Yes.
No, it's not.
Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm George Girding. I'm a consultant pharmacist. I'm certified in geriatrics. And I heard the name consultant pharmacist spoken earlier by the witness earlier, so I'm glad that was introduced. A lot of people don't know what consultant pharmacists do or where they are. Most of us do practice in geriatrics, and we are found in nursing homes reviewing the medications. That's what that focus is. Like any pharmacist, we're concerned about the appropriate use of drugs. And the way that it came to be, actually, we're mandated to be in every nursing facility in the United States to at least look at every patient's medication at least once a month. And frankly, we probably do it more now because patients are just so acute. But the way this came to be goes back to the 1970s when the federal government stepped in to rest homes in those days, nursing homes now, because they were, you know, frankly a mess and they were just not a good place to be. And part of that problem was, of course, the medications that were used were overused. You were seeing psychoactive drugs, particularly sedatives, being used with a heavy hand. After the government looked at that and put on many, many restrictions, they still weren't reducing the drugs in those places. And that's when they asked pharmacists to come in and perhaps get integrated into that system. And it wasn't long after that that actually they could see that decrease in the number of drugs once pharmacists were a part of that team. And in fact, they did a study not too long after that, a large study, just to say, you know, does this really pay off? Do we really get anything from this? And in fact, they found that indeed, with that pharmacist overview, it dropped the number of drugs somewhere like 40%, if I remember correctly, maybe a little bit higher than that. And of more importance was the adverse effects that were happening. The drug-related problems were reduced as well, and that's really what you want to look at. So that's how that specialty evolved. Now there are thousands of us in the United States that do this, and we still are mandated to do that. And you'll see us also in assisted living and some of the other areas of long-term care as we see this evolve. Now, I'm really telling you that just to tell you about what pharmacists do. As Shaw said, there's a lot of things we do, and probably before all of these people talk to you, you're going to see that it's quite broad. But it's that clinical approach that we sometimes get, the public just doesn't see. The pharmacist in your community is out there doing this sort of thing all the time. They're, you know, sometimes it looks like they're doing not much back there, but they usually are thinking this through, looking for adverse effects, looking for the proper way to take drugs. This is really what pharmacists are all about. What is interesting to me, of course, being involved in geriatrics and being one now, is that we have this combination of things that are happening. We're seeing, of course, people living longer, probably because we have such great drugs, with better quality of life. We're seeing, of course, as we live longer, our physiology changes, so we don't process drugs the same way. We are seeing people taking more drugs because of all this. We are seeing in our healthcare system this number of prescribers increasing, so it's not at all uncommon to have five different doctors. You know, if you have a cardiac problem, you have a cardiologist and so on. All of this means that we have more need for overview. And I was glad to hear Shaw talking about medication management. You can see this model that we've developed in the nursing home actually coming down into community practice. And for those of you that are setting the tone for healthcare in this state, I think it's important to know that we have a network of pharmacies and pharmacists trained to protect against those adverse effects. When you get down to it and you look at this, most of the drug-related problems are predictable and preventable. It's extraordinary to think about that, and then you look at the statistics about how many sneak through. And so, you know, I was glad to hear your concerns about adverse effects of drugs and the importance of, you know, the cards and so on. But we really need those specialists who understand about prevention of adverse effects with drugs to be out there doing that. So I put that before you. I'm sure you're going to hear from my colleagues more and more things about what pharmacists do. But in long-term care, at least, that's what consultants are doing.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Monitor.
Are you able to bill Medicaid for Medicaid services? For healthcare services with the Medicaid,
Senator Morissette and Senator Anderson, the most of the billing for consultant services is kind of a mix. It used to be years ago that it was part of the price of a prescription, but these days, of course, prescriptions, what you charge for a prescription, no matter where you are, is pretty much dictated by an insurance company or a third party. So oftentimes the billing for consultant services and other services has to come maybe from the patient somewhat, maybe in increased rent or wherever they are. And some of it is paid by the charge from the pharmacy, and some of it is paid by the nursing home. So it's kind of split up. And no, Medicaid does not pick up that service.
And for the pharmacists.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Anderson. We do bill for these services to the insurance companies. They do pay us for that.
For Medicaid?
For no, it's for Medicaid.
Just Medicare. Yeah, but not Medicaid.
Not for Medicaid.
And this bill would allow you to do that to
yes,
Medicaid patients.
I hope so.
Yeah. Senator Morissette and Senator Anderson, just what we're seeing with Part D is the ability to bill for the services I've described really at community level. So we're seeing some monies coming that way from Medicare, not Medicaid. So that, you know, to me is an important thing to look at, because we really need to pay for those services. We really need to have those services. And really, it should be paid for as a separate service rather than the cost of a drug. So it's nice to uncouple that, but it's always a task to get paid for it.
Now, some insurance companies will reimburse you and others will not. Is that what I've heard?
In consultants, in long-term care, likely not.
A pharmacist.
But at community level.
Yeah.
At community level, there are some insurance companies that will pay, and that is the trend that is going, and the reasoning for that one is, like George mentioned, it is the adverse events and the number of deaths that accompanies due to that, and the cost of hospital admission is so great that CMS mandated that we will go through all of their medication therapies.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, we'll move to the next. Thank you very much. Chris Digg. Butler? Not. Maybe close. And Wayne Corden. That's probably not even close.
Christine. Senator Morissette, for the record, my name is Christina Butler. I'm a doctor of pharmacy with Providence Health System. I'm a primary care clinical specialist. I'm board certified in pharmacotherapy. And I'm also president-elect for the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. I practice in an environment in primary care for Providence Medical Group in which 100% of my job is clinical services. I have no distributive function in my job. So my job is to help our physicians manage their very complex medical patients. My colleagues and myself do a lot of clinical services under a collaborative drug therapy management under Oregon statutes, which allow us to partner with a physician to manage disease states that they refer patients to us for. My colleagues and I do a lot, the majority of insulin initiation and titration for the patients in our medical group. We also do extensive amount of disease management, focusing on lipid and cardiovascular risk management in our patient population. Some example of how our services have added to the healthcare of our patients, we did a 2-year study in which we worked with 2,000 of our patients who have diabetes compared to the control arm of usual care of 8,000 patients. In focusing on cholesterol management, recognizing that patients who have diabetes have an extraordinarily high risk of adverse events, including heart attack and stroke and things like that. And getting those patients to cholesterol goals helps decrease those risks significantly, and that's been shown in numerous studies. Our physicians did a wonderful job compared to where they started. We were at about 29% of our patients were at goal, which is pretty dismal, but unfortunately reflective of what the entire country has been doing. Over the 2 years, the physicians were able to take up to 50% of their patients at goal. The pharmacists added to those services. We achieved 78% of the patients we worked with. So when we translate those numbers, we were able to prevent an additional several hundred events, meaning that if for every 11 patients that a pharmacist was involved with beyond what the physician was involved with, we would prevent an additional heart attack, stroke, or death.
That's impressive.
And we aren't reimbursed for our services. Pardon? So we are not reimbursed for our clinical services at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Other questions for Kristen?
Well, I don't see any yet, but there may be later. Go ahead.
Okay. Senator Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Krajan. I'm the Dean of the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University, and we're also affiliated with Oregon Health and Science University as a collaborative program with OHSU, and also the President-elect of Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Here to speak in favor of the bill, obviously, and it's a no-brainer that, yes, pharmacists are health professionals. That's the message we give to our students the day they walk into the College of Pharmacy. And just if you're not aware of this, to entry into the College of Pharmacy, our students have a minimum of 3 years of pre-pharmacy education, and then it's a 4-year professional program leading to a professional doctor of pharmacy like Christy has. And so our students are obviously well prepared. They are clearly health professionals. When you look at what in a pharmacy, a lot of people say the pharmacist is filling the prescriptions and putting pills in bottles and putting labels on them. Pharmacists rarely do that. Pharmacists are supervising that activity, but that activity is really being done by machines and by technicians. And when you get, all of you have some form of health insurance, I presume, and you have a pharmacy benefit, what's labeled as a pharmacy benefit, that's truly a drug benefit. And the bill that we heard before this one was really talking about the cost of drugs. And that's what everybody focuses on, is the cost of drugs, and basically looking at the cheapest, fastest way to provide the drugs, and that's done by oftentimes by supervised by pharmacists, but not by pharmacists. What this bill does, looks at, recognizes the fact that this is the pharmacy benefit, what people like Christy and Shaw and others that you've heard from can do. Now, I want to make it clear, one thing, that this bill does not make those services come to life. This bill simply provides the recognition that a pharmacist is a healthcare provider and is eligible for having registration and getting a healthcare provider number so that they can try to bill for services. Whether they will actually get billed for the services, that's a whole other step that's ahead of us. But until we have a provider number, the opportunity to have a provider number, we can't even start to try and bill for those services. Right now, a lot of people are billing patients cash, and people are willing to pay for those types of things. We're doing demonstration projects in diabetes management, similar to what Christy's doing, but in pharmacies. And we've worked with several city governments and self-insured groups. The pharmacists are being paid extra to care for patients with diabetes. The cost of drugs goes up for those patients. The cost of paying the pharmacist is an added cost to the care for those patients. But what we're seeing is that the total care of cost for those patients, the total cost of care for those patients is declining much more than the extra cost for the drugs, because they're using their drugs effectively. They're actually taking their medications that they weren't taking before. They're getting the needed benefit. They're not going to emergency rooms. They're not having adverse effects. So in summary, really what we are asking for is the recognition that pharmacists are healthcare providers. You all said that yourselves. You recognize that, and it's just kind of an anomaly that it's not there. And by getting this these couple of words added to the statutes then allows pharmacists to be eligible to have provider numbers, which then we'll take the next step and see what we can do to get people to recognize those services that we can provide, the ones that we've shown are cost effective. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson raised a question concerning inoculations for children, which I believe we had a discussion last session. Statutorily, we limited that to adults, I believe. Is that right, by statute? Is this going to allow you to do something?
This makes absolutely no difference there. That statute, this is only simply recognizing that pharmacists are health care providers and eligible for billing. No, we don't. Still won't know if they'll get billed for it, and they're eligible to do certain things, but this isn't going to make them more or less eligible to do any types of activities.
Okay.
But it does give them that recognition. We've talked about the Medicare and Medicaid. Right now, they can't bill for it because they're not listed as providers, and that's a loophole.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
A lot of pharmacists are starting clinics, which I visited some. It's very convenient for the patient. How does this relate to the health clinics that are being set up in conjunction with pharmacies?
I would suspect that many of those people are charging cash for that. They may negotiate, they may work with various provider groups, various insurance groups, and in some cases they may have received payment for it or received reimbursement, but by and large this is being either done gratis or being done as cash.
Senator Montes Anderson, I have a clinic within the framework of our physician group, so it's slightly different than a community practice environment. And under such, we can bill what's considered incident two billing. It's the lowest level that you would bill if you came in to get your blood pressure checked by a medical assistant. And our chief financial officer has deemed that that level of service is such a small amount of reimbursement for the clinical services that we provide that it's not even worth the paperwork to submit and the hassle of trying to submit it. So we currently are providing our services as an added benefit to our patients just as a part being part of our group. But our patients have expressed repeatedly their willingness to pay co-pays and things like that should it be deemed that we could bill for their services.
I don't see anybody from the insurance company here, so it must not be an important issue to them.
Gary's got a question.
Senator George, I think.
Oh, Senator George, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Thompson, when he testified, said that nothing in the bill extends the scope of practice, and then he made an additional statement that any scope of practice change would require additional either legislation, statutory change, or regulatory change. So I just wanted to get that on the record that you guys agree that we're not adding scope of practice.
Correct.
These are things that you currently do.
Correct.
Okay. It's two words. Two words.
I know.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 889 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 889 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Oh, yeah. Well,
yes.
Yeah. I believe that pharmacists are definitely health care providers. My concern is the impact of the billing piece. But that's not really what this bill is doing. It's just citing you as healthcare providers. And then the next step, I'm sure, will be when you try to get reimbursement rates, then you're going to have everyone coming, including DHS, and because that will affect our general revenue or our funds drastically. And so... just so that we know what an uphill battle this is going to be because there's not enough money in the system.
Well, I guess what we're saying is that this is cost savings on the backs of the pharmacists until we change the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd just say
You know. And you've already used up all your pills.
Yeah. Number one,
to keep track of these. You can't give them to the patient. It's a bad thing. Some of us have control issues, but and I just like Skittles. But okay, and you got two of them.
I know.
Understand that. I'd just like to say that over the course of our time in the building, because Senator George talked about scope of practice, we've expanded the scope, and we've done it in appropriate ways, and so for us not to recognize the fact that their healthcare providers is a bit absurd. So, like I said, it's two words. It's a good bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And for those words, I'll give you an extra package.
Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator
Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Montanson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Senate Bill 889, having received a constitutional majority, will move to the floor of the Senate, and I will carry the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we close the work session and open a work session on Senate public hearing. I'm sorry, we're going to skip the public hearing. On House Bill 2191.
Bill 2191 clarifies circumstances that constitute public assistance overpayment. It authorizes Department of Human Services to collect overpayments and begin garnishment proceedings. We do have a -1 amendment, which is in addition to what the House heard. Okay. It clarifies reference to public assistance as funds designated by DHS for a specific purpose.
Tricia Baxter, please. So we have an amendment. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery at the Department of Human Services. You've heard a lot about drugs this afternoon. I promise I won't mention drugs in my testimony.
You missed the skill.
True, I did. Okay. Well, now you won't believe a word I say. House Bill 2191 with the -1 amendment helps to expand the department's authority to collect back or to issue a billing to collect back overpayments of public assistance. It redefines some areas of overpayment that aren't clear currently. There's three specific areas that we're trying to address here. The first one is in a situation where a client comes into the office and they're in need of some emergency cash assistance. It could be that their electric bill is past due, their electricity is going to be turned off, or something of that nature. They get cash assistance to pay that bill. The next week they're back in. Their electricity is going to be cut off because they haven't paid their electric bill, but those funds have been spent. So they've spent those funds on a purpose other than the purpose that they were given those funds for. In that situation, current law does not allow us to write an overpayment, issue a billing to collect those funds back from that client. This bill, as amended, would allow us to do that. And the -1 amendment does address this specific situation. We worked with the Oregon Law Center when we were working on this bill in the House to change the language just slightly, and that's what is reflected in front of you. It now states that if funds have been spent differently than the specific purpose for which they were given to the client, that that would constitute an overpayment that could be assessed and then collected. The second situation that we're attempting to address here is when a client is funds are issued on behalf of a client, funds to which they were entitled, but these funds are to go to, say, a child care provider or an in-home service provider, and the client somehow intercepts those funds, cashes the check, and the funds never reach their destination, which is the provider, not the client. currently in those situations, we are not able to write up an overpayment and collect those funds back because the funds were issued appropriately. They were entitled to those funds. However, the funds were supposed to go to a different party than the party that actually received the funds. So this change in the statute would allow us to issue an overpayment in those situations and collect those funds back. The third situation is one that occurs with the veterans not quite often, but this is where we see this. Medicaid has funded a service for a client, and then later that client receives reimbursement from the Veterans Administration for those services. We have an administrative rule that requires that those funds be paid back to the department, but if they are not paid back, we have no authority to issue an overpayment and collect those funds back. So this bill would allow us to do that. Medicaid is intended to be the payer of last resort. This bill allows us to ensure that Medicaid is the payer of last resort. As all of you know, there are many Oregonians in need of our services at DHS. Our collections that we are able to bring back into the system make more funds available for those needy Oregonians. The other piece of this bill is simply a cleanup to our warrant and garnishment statute. The current statute indicates that a warrant must be recorded with the clerk of the county prior to being able to issue a garnishment. These are administrative warrants, and under general warrant and garnishment statute, they do not need to be recorded in order to execute on them. And in fact, we have not been recording all of our warrants because we feel that general statute allows us to go ahead and execute on those warrants by issuing a garnishment. This saves the state significant dollars. There's no point in recording a warrant with the county if there's no property for that to attach to. So this just cleans up that language for us to show that DHS can issue a garnishment on a warrant that is not recorded with the county clerk. So that simply is the bill you have in front of you. Again, the Dash 1 amendments were agreed to in the House. We weren't able to get them drafted, so we agreed to pass it out of the House and bring it to you with the amendment, understanding that it will need to go back to the House again for another vote. Okay. Be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Senator Cruz and then Senator DeJoy. Oh, everybody has questions.
thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, when you're going after a third party, whether it's VA or a third party, what's your minimum threshold?
I hate to say it depends, but generally we're not going to pursue something that is $50 or less. But to a certain extent, it depends, because if we're able to do things electronically and it doesn't cost the state an additional amount of money to do that, we would go ahead and bill the third party for any amount if it's an electronic process that's easy to do. We also have, in the case of third party, numerous clients that may have, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield as third party insurance, so we can send a number of claims to them at a lesser cost. So it really does depend on the situation.
Senator Verger and then Senator George.
Ms. Baxter, how much money do you have out on that you've given out on public assistance that you have not been able, that has not been spent?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, you know, I cannot answer that question. What I can tell you is that in the last fiscal year, our office recovered almost $62 million in funds. Now, not all of that is misspent funds. We have an estate administration program which recovers Medicaid dollars from the estates of individuals after they pass away. That's about $20 million per year. The actual overpayment related amounts are probably closer to $20 million in a year. That varies from year to year. And there's a lot of money still outstanding yet to be collected.
Ms. Baxter, this isn't your fault, but this is ridiculous. For anybody in business, why would you continue to write checks to people if they need their rent paid or their electricity to cover? Why isn't the check written to the company on behalf of that account?
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, that's an excellent question, and it's one that we often ask ourselves. The Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery was just established about a year and a half ago, and that's one of the very issues that we hope to be able to explore with our program partners. We're at the tail end of the process. Our goal is to get these corrected at the front end so we don't have to collect them later, and that's an excellent point and one that we are going to be looking at.
Will that be part of your performance measures?
Chair Morissette, we do have a performance measure that relates to outreach and working with our partners, and we include program staff within DHS as our partners. Our goal is to improve payment accuracy and recovery, and we do have a measure that addresses that.
Well, Ms. Baxter, not many businesses run a business this way. And I'm appalled that the state of Oregon would run a business this way. If the Veterans Association is going to pay a person and they've already been paid, then the veterans, you've already paid it. The Veterans Association should pay you, not pay the person, and depend on them to come pay you. But this is just common sense. This is not real high-tech business strategy here. And the only thing that I can say is that it's a poor way to run a railroad.
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, I agree. There's a number of things that we do, and it doesn't make much sense. Often that's statutorily in place, and I believe the situation with the veterans is that way. They get a lump sum payment. It's to cover a variety of things, and that's why we have an administrative rule stating that they need to repay us for the Medicaid funds. But I agree. If everything were perfect, we certainly wouldn't need our office around to recover these misspent funds.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. That was a perfect lead into my question. Because it is my understanding that we have a bill that's coming that requires that if a third party payer is going to pay a patient that is supposed to transfer those funds to a doctor, that this bill, what I was told about it, would be that it would have to require both people being on there. In other words, the doctor who had provided the service and the patient. And that makes a lot of sense relative to what Senator Berger just asked. And that was going to be my question, is why can't we tighten this up? And I suppose we're going to hear more from you on this. But it seems amazing to me. These are large dollars in many times that we're talking about, in which the person who provided the service doesn't get the money, and yet the person who perpetrated what I would describe as a crime, because if they had stolen that much money, they would be charged with a very serious crime. So I think this is one area of healthcare we really need to clean up. It's unfair to the person that paid. It's unfair to the doctor that provided the service. And so I suppose there's no question in there whatsoever. I'm sorry about that.
Well, I guess I'll be looking forward to seeing you in the Ways and Means Healthcare Subcommittee.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think it's basically all Katie King's fault.
Oh,
so.
Okay, other questions concerning the bill? We have John Mullen. Would you please come up? And you can just stay right there if you wish, Trish. Trisha. John, what can you add to this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, the Oregon Law Center, and I will be very brief. I just want to express our support for the Dash 1 amendments and appreciate the opportunity to work with Ms. Baxter from DHS and also with your committee staff, Ms. Weinbaum, in working out the Dash 1 amendments. So we believe, to begin with, the bill was overly broad as far as the lawful payments that are given benefits for clients, and the language addition of talking about for the specific purpose for which it's intended certainly meets our concerns. So we are satisfied and pleased to have worked with both DHS and your staff.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions?
Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2191.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2191.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2191. Discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Does this change the process at all? Or does the bill just seem to say that they can go after the people that have abused the system?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the system is flawed.
Yeah, Well, I don't think it changes the system. It focuses more precisely on who they're going on the details, on the circumstance.
Yeah, it gives them some ability to collect they don't currently have.
Yeah. It's improving the collection system, but it doesn't address your concern.
I guess my question is, since we're going to improve their ability to collect the funds, why aren't we doing something that's prevention that's in the bill?
Because it's not.
For the future.
I think that's a good topic.
That is, yeah. I'm assuming that this will come to the Ways and Means Subcommittee of Health and Human Services, I'm assuming. And at that point, I will certainly raise the question of very precise performance measures and how they're going to go about the collection to start with on the front end, which is what you're talking about. Who are they going to send the money to?
Sure. Yeah. We don't want to stop helping people.
Yeah.
It just simply that means if you tell me, if I tell them that I need the money for electricity, my house is cold, my children are cold, that's good. They're going to help me get that because it's an emergency, but they don't give me the money.
Just transfer it to the power company.
I go down to some place and buy beer or whatever.
You shouldn't do that.
I know. Since I don't drink beer, I thought it would be a really good thing to use. But nevertheless, I just think the system is so flawed in a good business sense, and I think that Mrs. Baxter agrees with me. I mean, she's just doing her job.
I know,
right.
But we need to do something to help her.
I would agree.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This bill has no minimal fiscal impact, so it will not go to Ways and Means.
I'm talking about the issue coming to Ways and Means. Yeah. When they're presenting their budget, it will then be discussed. Okay, further discussion. Any objections? Okay, seeing no objections.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2191 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Monahan?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
I'm going to vote no.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. The bill passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I was going to ask Senator Verger to carry the bill so she could voice her concerns while she's carrying the bill.
I will voice my concerns.
I know you will. Okay. I will carry the bill. Thank you very much. And there's one more bill, and Katie King, Ron McKay. Would you go ahead and I'll open the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2290 clarifies the types of facilities covered by DHS Foodborne Illness Prevention Program.
Okay. Ron, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I am Ron McKay, the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
The food inspection program in Oregon is divided between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Agriculture. Department of Human Services inspects food service facilities, basically restaurants and catering facilities. The Department of Agriculture is responsible for facilities that process and sell food, such as retail stores, bakeries, and food processors. The language in ORS 624.495 charges the Department of Human Services with preventing the spread of communicable disease through food dispensing facilities. And the problem is there is not a definition of food dispensing facilities. The bill proposes to change the language from food dispensing facility to food service facility, which is clearly defined. This would help assure there would be less or no confusion in the event of an emergency.
That's too simple. Let's make it a little bit more complicated so we can understand it. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie King, could you explain that to me in Spanish, please?
Sí.
Thank you.
Question. Senator, any questions?
No, I was just saying.
Wow.
Let's move on.
This is amazing. We need to,
Mr. Chair, we do need to get Katie King to actually testify in the closed session.
Would you give your name, please, and identify yourself?
Sure. I'm Katie King, the government relations person from the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services, and we wholeheartedly support this Department of Ag bill and hope you'll vote aye.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2290 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2290 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Montenegro?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 2290 passes, and we'll head to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry the bill?
She voted for it this time.
Okay. Senator Virgin gets
to carry
the bill. Very good. Thank you very much. And with that, we will close the work session and adjourn. Thank you.